The Salt Lake Film Society is screening Clint Eastwood's last Western, Unforgiven, tomorrow night. Kenneth Turan, the former film critic for the LA Times and Morning Edition, will be there, along with Andrew Nelson, scholar, head of the University of Utah's film department. Eastwood directed Unforgiven. He also stars in it as William Money, who was once a known thief and murderer, a man with a notoriously vicious and intemperate disposition. Andrew Nelson says when the film opens, William Money's fortunes and life have changed.
We actually get a title crawl that narrates in very formal language this backstory of him being a notorious outlaw who was reformed by a good woman. But we're told that that woman has since passed on, and we're then introduced to Money, the pig farmer. He's got two young children struggling in the mud to wrangle hogs. A far cry not only from a notorious gunslinger, but also from maybe Eastwood in general.
You don't look like no rootin' tootin' son of a bitch in cold-blooded assassin.
So the plot of the film centers around a bounty placed on a couple of cowboys by a group of prostitutes after one of them is abused. And the town sheriff, Little Bill Daggett, doesn't exact the justice that the women feel is warranted.
For what they've done, Skinny, get some ponies and that's it. That ain't fair, Little Bill. That ain't fair. Skinny, get some ponies and that's it.
So the cowboys kind of get off with a light sentence. They just have to bring in some ponies the next season, and that's about it. So that's what initiates the action of the film. And this opportunity, this bounty, is brought to Money's attention by a young gunslinger, calls himself the Schofield Kid.
What? You from Schofield?
Nah, on account of my Schofield model Smith & Wesson pistol.
So he's contemplating this because he recognizes it would be transformational, not just for him, but for his children, who are likewise out there in the mud with him. And so as he's thinking about this and more or less making up his mind, we see him try to reclaim some of that old self, to go through certain actions. But he's kind of comically inept. He can't shoot with his revolver. He tries it repeatedly, and there's a very funny moment where he gets out the shotgun, you know, blows the tin can to hell. And then after he's decided to go and he's telling his children what they need to do,
you kill a few chickens if you have to and keep those hogs who got the fever separate.
And he's trying to get on a horse that has not been ridden for God knows how long. And the horse is resisting and he's jumping up and down. And as he's doing it, Money starts, you know, narrating why the horse is doing this. It's kind of his revenge for all the wickedness of his past when he would, you know, abuse an animal like this.
This horse, hogs over there.
He's eventually able to get up in the saddle and ride off. It is an opening that goes to great lengths to establish just how far this guy is, not necessarily fallen, but how far away he is from the man he was that established a certain reputation for him. It's a really impactful opening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Unforgiven because tomorrow night, you'll have a chance to see it on the big screen at the Broadway Center Cinemas. Now, as we said, the film critic Kenneth Turan will be there. We'll hear from him in a moment. We asked the film scholar Andrew Nelson to take us through Unforgiven. So it goes without saying, I guess, there are spoilers. But we wanted to talk about the story and the themes and where the film fits in the history of movie westerns. That's where we began our conversation.
So the early 90s is an important moment in the history of the Western. What we have over the course of the 1970s is the genre gradually fading away as a popular genre. Mm. The Western doesn't die. It just moves to other places. There's still a lot of Westerns made late 70s, all throughout the 80s, but mostly on television. But as a popular genre, you know, the 1980s, Westerns are few and far between. There are a few.
Yeah.
That are popular, but there are always qualifications. You know, Young Guns is popular. Is it popular because it's a Western, or is it popular because it's got all these Tiger Beat cover boys
on
it?
Yeah, right? Brat Packies. Yeah,
exactly. So There are a couple of things that happened, though, in the late 80s, early 90s. One is a miniseries called Lonesome Dove, which is based in the Larry McMurtry novel, is on CBS in the late 80s and is very popular. It's got big-name movie stars in it, Tommy Lee Jones and Robert Duvall. That does very well. And then, more importantly, Kevin Costner, who had accumulated a lot of capital over the course of the 80s as a star, decides it's time for him to become a director. And that isn't enough. He wants to direct an epic Western, Dances with Wolves. The press leading up to it is not favorable. People think this is going to be a disaster. They start calling it Kevin's Gate, reference to Heaven's Gate, the Michael Cimino film that also, you know,
was a disaster.
Was a disaster and did not help the Western's cause. But to everybody's surprise, it is a massive hit. And it opens the door for a new kind of Western movie making, where a Western doesn't necessarily have to be a blockbuster and be popular. It can be a serious film that's designed to win Oscars. So this door opens and we get the first really genuine revival of the Western cinematically since, you know, maybe the mid-70s. And it's actually the last time there's ever been a critical number of Westerns in our cinemas at the same time, this sort of period 1990 to about 95, 96. So very quickly into this new opening rides none other than Clint Eastwood with a script that he's been sitting on for a long time. And, you know, Eastwood has downplayed the degree to which the success of Dances with Wolves enabled him to do this. But the time was certainly right for him to make this script, and that film was Unforgiven.
Do you remember when you first saw it?
I absolutely do. I saw it on home video probably like 1993. And it's, you know, really one of the first Westerns I remember seeing. And I think that was a common experience for people because the Western was not a part of popular culture. So suddenly you have all of these films emerging, and I think those set the tone or kind of established the idea of what a Western is for many people. So Tombstone, Unforgiven, Dances with Wolves, for many people of my generation, that is what a Western is. And I guess a challenge with that, though, is that those films were, of course, conceived by people who had a great idea of what the Western had been before, that these films are very self-conscious about their engagement with Western history. And that's certainly the case with Unforgiven. It's a Western that knows it's a Western and also goes to great lengths to educate, in a sense, the viewer about what a Western is and is not.
It's self-aware.
Absolutely.
Huh.
Absolutely. I mean, the comparison I make is to Scream, the horror film that came out in 96. I mean, Unforgiven is essentially the Scream of Westerns. I'm going to trademark that phrase.
Do.
Now that I've just said it. It's very clever. But so, you know, Scream is what some people call the postmodern slasher film.
Yeah.
Right? It's a film in which the characters are aware of the rules of the slasher film. And a lot of energy is expended telling the viewers. And part of the idea is kind of it's kind of marketing that you have all these viewers who maybe don't know Halloween, don't know Friday the 13th. So we're going to distill this down to rules. We'll have characters talk about this explicitly. The viewer will think, oh, I know the rules. I know what a slasher film is. And then the film plays with that knowledge. Unforgiven is actually very similar. Unforgiven is a film where characters at different points say, well, this is what an Old West hero is like. And then they'll be corrected. No, no, no. That's not what an Old West hero was like. That's not what the Old West was like. This is what the Old West was like. This is this kind of game of trying to empower the audience with knowledge that they can then use to make judgments about what's going to happen. And at the same time, not really violating any of those conventions. Unforgiven is a film that spends a lot of time telling us that the myths of the Old West were just that, myths if not lies, only to have the mythical gunfighter who the movie has spent over 2 hours telling us did not exist emerge like a force of nature and deliver the type of cleansing justice that we associate with the Western in its heyday.
So let's bring another character into the film. This is the Morgan Freeman character, Ned.
Ned Logan, yeah.
I like this moment too where he is trying to convince himself, I think, William Money, that he, as he says, he's just a fellow now.
Yeah, I ain't like that no more.
Yeah.
I'm just a fella. Yeah.
Does he believe it?
I've seen this film many times, and I think that he doesn't believe it. And I think that explains why he really just mentions two things. It was the booze, and then my wife cured me of it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of as simple as that. But he's, of course, a much more complex character.
Yeah.
And reducing it all to the vice of alcohol seems like somebody trying to convince himself of something that he doesn't believe.
Kenneth Turan, in his review, said some of the questions that he saw playing out in the film. One of them is, can Ned and William, can they still kill the same way?
Right.
Do they still have it?
Yeah.
And will they be able to turn around once they have and return to the quiet of their lives?
Yeah.
Do you think that those are the questions that – some of the questions that are resonating?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, so much of the mythology around the Western is that, you know, the hero is inextricably linked with violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ask the question, why does the hero have to ride out of town at the end of the day? And one answer to that is, well, because he's so associated with violence, he doesn't have a place in the society that his violence has helped to bring into being. Mm-hmm. So he's purged the garden of evil, but he himself, because of his association with that same evil, has no place in it. So that would be a kind of, you know, a mythical reading,
yeah,
an almost biblical reading of why we see these rituals play out time and time again. So it's fair to ask the question then, you know, can this person, you know, exist in society? What's interesting about Unforgiven is it suggests that these guys have kind of moved on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their lives are not glamorous, but they're still alive. You know, they have families. In the case of Money, he's got a couple of children. In the case of Ned, he's got an Indian wife. Right, so it's not as though that they're under any like significant hardship. Like we know Money's in tough, but it's not as bad as it could be. And he's,
yeah,
you know, he's alive.
Yeah.
You know, he's not dead. So by that standard. So it does become a question of whether they can go back to that former life. The attraction is clearly there,
mm-hmm,
especially for Ned. Like we understand the money is important, but Ned helps to bring out the sense that, well maybe it's more about the drama, you know, the action of the particular moment. Of maybe we've lost something there.
Mm.
And the question, which is in the review, is can you reclaim a little bit of that without compromising who it is that you have become?
Tell us about the script, the screenplay, as,
yeah,
as it comes to us. So Eastwood gets his hands on it,
yes,
eventually and hangs on to it. But how does it come about?
You know, so interesting genesis. So the screenwriter is David Webb Peoples,
yeah,
who contributed – is probably, other than this, best known for having contributed to Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So as the story goes, as he tells it, Peoples conceived of this movie in the 1970s, which I think is important. When he tells, well, because the film in many ways is a lot like a Western from the 1970s.
Huh.
Now, when Peoples talks about it, he doesn't bring up contemporary Westerns all that much. He always brings up Taxi Driver, that he thought, you know, Taxi Driver so impressed him because it was a film that had a very serious disposition towards violence. It was a film where he felt very strongly that violence had consequences,
mm-hmm,
in a particular way. So in that context, he writes this script. And it is kind of shopped around. Francis Ford Coppola initially has it. But after Coppola's attempt to make a big musical in 1982.
Another disaster.
One from the Heart.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how, yeah, we've got the Western goes away. This is what also the musical's killed,
yeah,
supposedly by one film. You know, not going to be in a position to make it. So Eastwood acquires the script and, as the story goes, you know, wants it for himself but doesn't think that he's old enough to play Money at this particular point. So he sits on it until 1992. Now, the reason I bring up the 70s context being so important is that the plot of this film is almost identical at a very high level to the plot of almost all of John Wayne's last Westerns. Also, you know, last Westerns made by people like Burt Lancaster or Gregory Peck. You know, the seasoned old Western veteran, the kind of a godfather of the West character.
One last ride.
Saddles up for one last ride. Exactly,
yeah,
that. So the movie in many ways is not that far removed from a True Grit or Big Jake, and that shouldn't surprise us because those are the types of stories the Western was telling at that particular moment. So it's kind of like John Wayne in his later years plus Taxi Driver, and you get Unforgiven.
What does Unforgiven say about the myth of the American West? Turan says that he thought, at least in his initial review, that the frontier West It showed the frontier West coming to an end, physically and spiritually. What do you think it says about the West?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask and what their perspective is. And that's actually okay. I think the film is aware of this, that it is, like most popular American films, designed to allow a number of different interpretations. So the idea that, you know, this film is different from earlier Westerns because it's about the end of the West is not true. The West is always coming to an end. That's kind of the driving story in most canonical Westerns. I mean, that's Stagecoach. You know, that's High Noon. You know, that's even The Searchers, the idea that this is kind of the last moment before the pioneers finally, you know, in the case of The Searchers, you know, eradicate American Indians. That's what's exciting about the West, is it's always at this moment of transition where it's about to end. And that's what's exciting to us about it. It's a kind of this moment of possibility before all of these possibilities are closed down by the next step in the nation's evolution. So I don't think it's especially novel in that regard, but it is – it's obviously interested in that, and it's interested in questions of what does it mean to transition from a kind of a Wild West to a civilized West. And what Unforgiven suggests, and this is very conventional, is that civilization ain't that civilized and that there's maybe something to be said for the wilderness, that when you get the town, it doesn't necessarily mean you get – law and order in the sense that we would like, that there's a continuity there, that if the people are the same, you know, maybe their jobs have changed, maybe they've got a badge now, you know, maybe they're in a position to tell you how it really was, but deep down they're still who they were 10 or 20 years earlier when they were really bad men. A badge does not make a hero, we might say.
So being an expert of Eastwood and John Wayne, you know the story of the letter that John Wayne – not supposedly, apparently
– He wrote
Clint Eastwood.
He did.
Telling him he didn't like – John Wayne didn't like High Plains Drifter and told Eastwood that in a letter. And he said that it wasn't about the people who really pioneered the West.
That's right. And
– What Eastwood got from that was that, okay, there are different generations here. He's of a different generation from mine, that he's not going to understand what I'm doing. What do you make of that story and what John Wayne was getting at and what I think Eastwood may have taken from that?
Well, I think it's important to remember that this is a particular point in John Wayne's life. It's not as though John Wayne hadn't made films where the townsfolk were less than heroic. Right. I mean, again, we could go right back to, Stagecoach. It's kind of breakout role in some senses. That is a movie with two towns, and they're both terrible.
Yeah.
Right. One is filled with sanctimonious busybodies who expel the undesirable elements of society, and so they go on a stagecoach ride where they form a little community of their own. But where do they end up? Like a town filled with outlaws and brothels and so on.
Yeah.
Right, like the town is not great there. Even a film like Rio Bravo, let's say, which in his later years Wayne saw as a response to High Noon, which is a film where the townsfolk are quite cowardly, by one view. Well, in Rio Bravo, the townsfolk are irrelevant; they're just not there at all. So it's not as though all of Wayne's films were glowing portrayals of the pioneers who had made the country what it is today. But at that particular moment in his career, I mean, I think that was his perspective. And that was certainly what impressed him negatively about the film, is that this was a town – maybe it made him think of High Noon, and that would make sense because High Plains Drifter is Eastwood's version of High Noon, we might say, that did just sort of suggest that there were no good people here, none whatsoever. And so it's reasonable to object to that. And then, likewise, Eastwood is at a different stage of his career.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to make Westerns. He's almost exclusively making Westerns that are in dialogue with earlier Westerns. So it could be partly, well, this is what I believe, but it could also be, well, I need to make this different in some way. Again, so that the myth speaks to contemporary viewers.
And because their ideology, political ideology, John Wayne's and Clint Eastwood's, I can't be that far apart.
Pretty much aligned in some respects.
Yeah.
I mean, we associate them maybe with different parts of the right,
sure,
but certainly with the right. And I think it's telling that Eastwood's last Western is in many respects the type of Western that Wayne made. about a mythical hero returning and in so doing suggesting that there's a kind of higher moral order, a sense of cosmic justice that these great heroes can tap into from time to time as kind of like forces of nature almost. And you know the fact that I see the film Unforgiven is quite not only like Wayne's films but quite conventional, quite traditional, and I don't mean those in bad ways, is an indication that you know once Eastwood got to that same stage of his career, he was probably in the same place. You know, and if there had been a younger generation of Western filmmakers in the 90s, maybe they would have had that dialogue all over again. But there, you know, there weren't. There was no equivalent to Wayne to tell Eastwood what was happening at that point.
It's Andrew Nelson. He's an associate professor of film and media arts at the University of Utah. They're co-sponsoring a screening of Unforgiven tomorrow night at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll have a link with all the details on our website. Here are the basics. The film begins at 7. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. All right, let's talk about another character and another really terrific performance in Unforgiven. This, of course, is Gene Hackman. He plays Little Bill. Yeah. He's the sheriff, the no-nonsense sheriff who's interested in law and order, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's trying to build his own house, and he's terrible at it, which just seems charming. But then there's the other side to him, which is incredibly dark. He's sadistic.
Yes.
So just talk a little bit about this character, if you would.
Yeah, he ain't no carpenter, one of the best best lines in the movie. I think there's a connection to be made here to the other characters like Ned and Money who are trying to leave a certain life behind but also know that something about their old life is necessary for them to have this new life that they envision. Mm. That's kind of the tension. So Little Bill wants to have a house, wants to have a kind of domestic life, wants to live in a quiet town where there's law and order, but he recognizes there can only be law and order because of superior force. So you know, it employs a very common Western trope, the lawman who passes the law, no guns in town, that sort of thing, who has a motley crew of deputies who are only effective insofar as they have guns and their adversaries don't and they have superior numbers. So it's quite conventional in that sense. But he is a fascinating character. A lot of that is down to Hackman's performance. Hmm. He is self-possessed, confident, and so on. But it's a great performance in that our perspective of him changes over the course of the movie. Hmm. That he starts out as a character we're inclined to like.
Okay, so it brings us to another great character and another really terrific performance. This is the great actor Richard Harris.
Yes, amazing.
Who plays this character, English Bob. Okay, so there's the scene I want you to set up for us, if you would. English Bob has with him a writer, his biographer, who's traveling with him, who is believing the myths of the West as he goes. And he is, in his writing, he's tarting up his writing with the ideas that – the myth of the gunslinger.
Yes.
So talk about what happens when English Bob confronts, or the other way around, Little Bill confronts English Bob, and to the writer dismantles the idea of what it's actually like to draw a gun and kill someone. So do you take us through this?
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating dynamic, and this is one of the real delights of the film in many ways, and also a thing that the film does, which is very clever because it inclines the viewer to adopt a certain perspective to different characters, and then the film plays with that. Mm. So what's interesting about the Beauchamp character, so he's
– That's the writer.
That's the writer, yeah, played by Sal Rubinstein. Great performance.
It is.
Is he – he doesn't actually see himself as a mythologizer. He's tagging along with English Bob because he's getting the real story because English Bob was there. And in the present, English Bob is very confident. He's very proficient with firearms. So why would he not believe this charismatic Englishman? So he isn't aware that he's mythologizing. He thinks he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
Right? So that sets up the great irony where in the town of Big Whiskey, and Bob has come seeking the bounty, right? Bob has not disarmed himself, according to the ordinance, and so he is summarily beaten viciously in the middle of the town street, where all, including the prostitutes, can see, as Little Bill yells out to everybody that there ain't no whore's gold, and he's telling it to everybody far and wide, essentially. That's not what he's doing. I'm not beating you, Bob. I'm sending a message to all those people,
yeah.
So on and so forth. So what follows is a scene in the prison where Beauchamp is able to establish his credentials as a writer to Little Bill. And so Little Bill lets him out of the cell. We've got a beaten English Bob sitting there, barely able to speak, able to raise his head.
Yeah.
And there's an exchange between Beauchamp and Little Bill. Beauchamp starts telling him about the stories that have been recounted to him by English Bob. And it turns out that Little Bill was there. And thus begins this interesting dialogue between the writer and the lawman,
yeah.
Right? No, this is what really happened, right? Why was this guy called Two Guns? He didn't carry two guns,
yeah,
because of his massive, well, you know what.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying because it's completely deconstructing the myth by somebody who was there in a way that seems plausible, right? The idea that, you know, it isn't really about staying cool, calm, and calculated. There's an element of risk and luck. You know, guns will malfunction, will misfire at particular times. That never makes it into the movies, never makes it into the story, supposedly. So we have a kind of truth-telling moment,
yeah,
here. But what is subtly happening, and we recognize this as audience members very quickly, is that all Beauchamp has done is substitute one mythologizer for another. So very quickly, Little Bob will start talking about his own frontier philosophy. Right? That he doesn't like assassins and men of low character. He's pontificating in ways that are eerily like English Bob, foreshadowing, in a sense, what's going to happen next.
So one of the sort of most powerful, I don't know if themes, but certainly one of the most powerful questions that comes up in the story is, what is it actually like to kill,
yeah,
to kill a man, as,
yeah,
as they say.
Yeah.
And there are two prominent scenes that really give us a sense of this. Would you take us through the scene where the young man named the Schofield Kid,
yeah,
who's brought William money and Ned into this,
yeah,
bounty search,
yeah,
in the first place, actually does kill a man. It's a And his reaction to,
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So the first of the two cowboys is dispatched from a distance. Ned is going to do it because he's the sharpshooter, but he loses his nerve. Money has to step in, and he kind of the cowboy's gut shot, and he's dying.
Slowly.
Very slowly, asking for water. And it's, you know, the Schofield Kid, who by this point we realize is short-sighted, literally. Can't see anything, so he's asking, you know, is he dead? What's going on down there? So that scene is a very kind of anticlimactic one. So the camera work, very still, very placid, kind of really emphasizing how unglamorous this scene particularly is. Now with the next one, the second cowboy is basically under house arrest. He's got a lot of protection around him, but he asks to go out to the outhouse. And that's where the Schofield Kid sneaks up, opens the outhouse door, and just shoots him. Bang, bang. That's it. Runs away. The other lawman cowboys in the bunkhouse come out. They're shooting. And it's a more exciting scene because there's chaos, confusion, smoke. The camera is moving, so on. But it's still kind of, you know, unglamorous.
Yeah.
You know, throwing open the outhouse door and shooting a man.
In his most vulnerable position.
Absolutely. Right.
Right.
Doesn't seem like a heroic moment.
Yeah.
And indeed, it isn't. And it is that like lack of glamour that really hits the Schofield Kid. So he begins to break down. You know, he reveals that he, in fact, hasn't killed any man. He's made himself out to be a big gunfighter, but he never has. And he's thinking in his mind, you know, what it was like to shoot this guy. And Money says, you know, it's a hell of a thing killing a man. Take away all he's got, all he's ever going to be. And that's about all he can say about it. It is a powerful moment. It is not the first time that a youth in a Western has learned a hard lesson about the terrible toll that violence takes on you. I mean, this happens time and time again, but it's certainly a very 90s one. Right? It's a very unglamorous act, and we see the character. He talks it out. He narrativizes it. Right? He's trying to build up in his mind what it was. Right? He's trying to convince himself. But so much of this movie is about characters talking and trying to convince themselves of something that they know is not true.
So we talked earlier about this question about whether or not William Money is convinced he can – he's a regular fella.
Yeah.
And he's given up the drink.
Yeah.
But there's a moment right after this scene, in
yes.
fact, where it's almost as if he physically transforms into the old William Money.
Yes. Yeah. A brilliant scene, and some of Eastwood's very best acting, I think. It's almost everything that's great about Eastwood, because there's so little dialogue and so much of it is gesture and expression. So so just after the Schofield kid and Money have this exchange, one of the prostitutes rides out, gives them the money, and you know Money casually mentions how you know they're going to meet up with Ned and divvy up the money as planned, and the prostitute reveals that Ned's dead, that he had been apprehended by Little Bill and his deputies. And he'd been whipped to death for not giving up information. Well, to a point. He was whipped until he decided to start giving up information, start talking about what was going to happen when Will Money found out about it, about who he was, William Money, killer of women and children. So as the realization of what has happened to Ned dawns on Money, so does the realization of what he must do and who he must become. So we very casually no one talks about it. No one says this. Takes a bottle, uncorks it, starts drinking. And we see him transform before our eyes from, you know, William Money, broken down pig farmer, to, you know, the Will Money of legend, this notorious bandit who killed without a second thought. And that is who Little Bill Daggett has invited. That's who Ned has almost summoned with his dying words, and that's who we're going to get for the last 15 minutes of the movie.
We don't need to process what happens right at the end. But I want to ask you about the idea of whether anyone deserves
yes.
this, because it does come up. And William Money, again, the writer trying to get William Money to process
yes.
what he does at the end, and he's sure that he's thought it all out.
Yeah.
That he killed these men that he does at the end in a particular order.
Yes.
With intent.
Yes, because Little Bill told him that's what a skilled gunman will do.
Yeah.
Right. We'll try to take out the best shot first.
But he said, that's not how it works. No. I was lucky in the order.
He's lucky in the order, but then I've always been lucky when it comes to killing folks. So that is an interesting moment. Now, there is a possible connection to an earlier Eastwood film. In The Outlaw Josie Wales, there's a confrontation where Josie Wales, Eastwood's character, is outnumbered. And then the aftermath of that, he's asked by Chief Dan George, you know, who he decided to shoot first and why. And Eastwood in that moment, right, Eastwood 1976, provides a very detailed rationale, you know, based on how the characters were looking, who had what kind of holster and so on.
Wow.
Right? So when I see this, I think, well, this seems like Eastwood is actually contradicting himself in 1976, much as John Wayne would often do over the course of his career, if we want to tie it back to that. But in the context of Unforgiven, it makes sense because, you know, Beauchamp has now imbibed this idea of the kind of the rational gunslinger, right, who is, you know, who's almost analyzing the scene and making decisions coolly. The idea that that isn't the way it works, that it was just – it's literally just luck, and I've always been lucky when it comes to killing folks, makes Money seem more like a force of nature. I mean, it's not a coincidence that there's driving rain when Eastwood comes into town. It's not a coincidence that earlier in the film, there's also a big storm, and Little Bill's terrible carpentry cannot keep the rain from coming into his house. So Eastwood is kind of Western justice personified, right? Not you know, justice in terms of wearing a badge or not, but a kind of cosmic justice, which is often the case in a Western. Mm-hmm. It's very common for characters to throw off their badge and recognize that this is a personal affair. But we excuse it because we recognize there's a higher law than the law here of the land, right? Cosmic justice, let's say. So in that moment, Eastwood kind of undercuts everything that Little Bill had told Beauchamp, just as Little Bill did that with English Bob. The difference, though, is that Eastwood seems to have more of a reluctance to self-mythologize himself. Mm-hmm. But he's doing it anyway. A line like that, you know, "I've always been lucky when it comes to killing folks," is a great line. And then when Money leaves the saloon, he starts yelling. You know, I think these lines are hilarious because they are so on the nose about how, you know, "Nobody better come out, right? You better bury Ned Wright, right? Or I'm going to come back and kill all you sons of bitches." And he's, you know, he rides out of town in the rain. The prostitutes come out and they're watching him, you know, ride away like Shane or something like that, but just with a higher body count. It's so mythical almost.
Well, it gets back to the question then that you raised earlier.
Sure.
It's trying to have it both ways. It's trying to be the revisionist Western, whatever that means, and it's trying to be the traditional Western. So does it? Does it get to have both ways? Does it succeed in both of those things?
You know, I think it does. And I think this is what makes it a great Western, because this is so often the case with so many great Westerns. I've looked really closely in an essay a number of years ago at the response to Unforgiven. It was remarkable to me how there were, you know, one group of critics, even viewers, who were really inclined to see this as a rigorous debunking of the myths of the West. And then there's another group who are just, you know, really excited when Eastwood shows up and kills everybody at the end, right? In the manner of Western heroes of old, you know, the man with no name kind of appears in a certain guise at the end. And I think that's okay. I think that's actually great. I mean, this is like the Searchers. How is it some people come out of that film seeing Ethan Edwards, John Wayne's character, as a monster, and others see him as the greatest American hero? Right? How is it people can watch Gary Cooper as Marshal Will Cain in High Noon and come up with very different interpretations? Mm-hmm. Some people think that he's the greatest lawman of all time, and others think that what he's doing is completely wrong. I mean, that's the way great American movies work. There's a kind of ambiguity there, which I think explains some of the power that you have to insert yourself to a certain degree and see the film in a way that's going to work for you. And Western has always been very good about that. And that's what makes it powerful as a mythical form. You know, myths don't tell us to think one particular thing, right? Because people rebel when they're told you must think this. It's much more subtle than that. Even if Unforgiven is not an especially subtle film in some moments, even if there's a lot of, again, dialogue, it's with intention, right? The film knows what it's doing, and what it's doing is what the best Westerns have always done. It's dramatizing these kind of eternal questions about right and wrong, hero and villain, law and order, and when violence is justified.
Andrew Nelson, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Doug.
Andrew Nelson, he's chair of the Department of Film and Media Arts at the University of Utah, author of the book Still in the Saddle, the Hollywood Western 1969 to 1980. You can see Unforgiven on the big screen tomorrow night at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll put a link with the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Clint Eastwood's last Western. The movie Unforgiven is about a reformed killer who takes one last job. Now, there's a screening of the film tomorrow night at the Broadway Center Cinemas. The former LA Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan will be there. In his review of the film when it came out more than 30 years ago, Turan said it resonated with the spirit of the past, but also managed to stake out new territory.
Well, the old stuff is that, you know, there's never any doubt who the protagonist is, you know.
Yeah.
He's, you know, I guess he's the anti-hero in a sense, but he's definitely the hero. And, you know, he has a journey and adventures, and he has sidekicks, and he has enemies. You know, there are all these things that we're used to having. But I think what struck me as most modern was the kind of revisionist nature of it. The fact that it really, even though there's violence in the film, it really tries very hard and, you know, very intentionally to demythologize killing, you know, to say, you know, to show us how difficult it is to kill someone and how much it takes out of the people who do the killing, which is something Westerns have not always gone into. If you kill a bad guy, it's supposed, you're supposed to, you know, feel great about it. And that's not so clear cut in this film.
Yeah. You said that it was hard to imagine this film in anyone's hands except for Clint Eastwood's. What was it that you were seeing that was particularly, you know, the style, the sense of Clint Eastwood?
Well, he's an iconic figure. You know, he's the man with no name, you know, starting with the Sergio Leone Western, starting even with Rawhide, you know, which he did on TV for many seasons. You know, he is just, he is, for today's audiences, he is the iconic Western hero. There's nobody who comes even close. And so if you're going to do revisionism, you don't want to have someone in the lead who is just not really the ultimate hero, because the revisionism will feel weak. When you have a hero that strong, to do revisionism with him is very powerful.
I want to ask you about... You did an interview with Clint Eastwood around the time of Unforgiven. Before I get to some of the responses he gave you, which I think are quite telling, what's it like to interview Clint Eastwood? Like, what is it like? Is he game to talk about his process or talk about how he's thinking about some of the themes in his films? Or is he, or can he be like someone like John Ford, who had no patience for something like that? I mean, what's he like?
No, he's not like John Ford, you know. And, you know, I don't know how much what John Ford did was kind of an act.
Yeah.
But he's definitely not like that. No, he's, you know, if you ask a good question, you'll get a good answer. Hmm. You know what I mean? He's very honest. He's very accessible, you know, and it's kind of up to you as an interviewer to ask. And it's always, no matter who you talk to, and I've done an enormous amount of interviewing in my time, it's up to you to ask an involving question, you know, and if you ask an involving question, he won't blow it off the way John Ford would. He will answer it. So, you know, he's very straight ahead. He's very honest. He's very direct. He's really a pleasure to interview.
One of the things you asked him about was kind of his relationship with the genre of Westerns. And it was interesting. He said to you that he never wants to do any particular genre or any particular film just for the sake of the genre itself. He says it's always the individual story. What does that say about Clint Eastwood and the films that he's directed and the things that interest him, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, it's on the most basic level. I mean, this is true of most, you know, when he says that, he sounds to me like an actor, because actors really, you know, they're interested in the individual part. You know, they're not really interested in how this fits into their career or, you know, what it says. They want a really involving plot to play. And I think as a director, Eastwood is looking for involving stories. I mean, that's different stories may involve him in different ways, but that sense, that need for personal involvement is key for him, as it is key for a lot of good filmmakers.
I want to ask about another performance. In Unforgiven, you write about Gene Hackman, and you said it was, at least at the time, I mean, he's done a number of films since, of course, but you said at the time it was one of his most powerful and least mannered performances. That's how you put it. Talk about what you meant. What did you see in Gene Hackman's portrayal of Little Bill?
He's a very most of the time he's a very relaxed guy.
Yeah.
You know, He's the sheriff of this town. Everyone, you know, kind of quakes when he approaches. Mm-hmm. He's got his life where he wants it. You know, it feels like you know, again, one of the things that I love about the Little Bill character is that he's just quirky. Yeah. All the characters are much quirkier than you might expect or that you really would need to have them. I mean, he's a guy who clearly this is the dream of his life is to build his own house.
Right.
And he's finally gotten to the place where he can literally physically build it. And by all reports, by everyone in town, he's terrible at it. You know, he cannot build, you know, a house to save his life. And, you know, that's just one of those things, you know, it's just, again, it's quirky. It's quirky, but a lot of films wouldn't take the time to put that quirky character trait in there. They'd say, well, how does it advance the story? You know, we got to cut that out. But by making the character richer and deeper and more unexpected, it very much advances the story.
Well, quirky, but also then he's deeply sadistic. That's an interesting contrast, right?
Well, again, these, I mean, David Peoples, who's a terrific screenwriter, well, he was one of the credited writers on Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
He worked on a great documentary called The Day After Trinity. He did the script on that. You know, when you have a screenwriter that good, you get real people. And real people don't necessarily add up. And this genial, you know, inept carpenter doesn't necessarily go together with the sadistic sheriff, but they are the same people. Mm-hmm. And Hackman makes you believe it. He's a good enough actor that he makes both sides of this character believable.
Let me steal a question from you and put it to you instead of Clint Eastwood as you did. What is it about the Western that makes it so resilient?
Huh, that's a good question.
It is a good question. That's your question.
It's my question. I don't know. I think partly because it's part of our past. You know, we grew up with it. I mean, it's resilient for me because the first stuff I remember watching on television as a kid, a young kid, were these Hopalong Cassidy movies, which were kind of repurposed B pictures that Cassidy was shrewd enough to get the rights to and reformat for television. You know, so it's both our national past and often our personal past. And because the figures are very iconic, you know, we've even taken the, you know, the phrase, the man with the black hat in a more general sense. But in Westerns, the bad guy literally wore a black hat. You know, I'm watching a lot of B Westerns lately and literally the bad guys show up in black hats, and, you know. So it's very iconic in its, you know, in its story elements, you know, and that's, I think, and it's got action, you know, it's got horses, you know, it's got a lot of galloping and roping and riding. It's got a lot of things going for it.
Clint Eastwood told you in response to that question that the reason he thought it might resonate, the Western, is because of the simplicity of the times, or at least the idea that it was more simple time. And he said to you, now everything's so complicated, so mired in bureaucracy that people can't fathom a way of sorting it out. And so it's appealing, I think, is what he was saying, that you have this, you know, lone individual who's just sorting this thing out and working it out. Now, that may be a reflection of his kind of, you know, famously conservative ideology, you know, bureaucracies and governments complicating things or whatever it might be. But I thought it was interesting that he thought that that was what appealed to him anyway, is that there was a kind of simplicity that people didn't experience now. Do you think that's one of the things that he liked about it?
Yeah, I think that's quite true. I think that's quite true. I mean, you know, that's a really one of the essences of the Western's appeal, is that you can straighten things out, you know, by the end of the film, things are straightened out, you know, and that's very satisfying to experience, partly because in everyone's life, it's not as easy to straighten things out. You know, there are issues that come up, you know, that really resist straightening out. It may take you years to straighten them out. They may never get straightened out. So to be able to experience a story where the hero gets to make things right, gets to make everybody happy, gets to take care of the situation, gets to straighten things out. Well, that's very satisfying. I mean, I think Eastwood's answer was quite a good one and quite accurate.
What do you think is left for Clint Eastwood? I know it's hard to say with a man who's 93, approaching 94, but, you know, he's held on for a good amount of time. It's interesting that he told you that if he were going to do a last Western, that he thought Unforgiven would be it, because he said it kind of sums up what he feels. But what do you think is, if you can, if anyone can discern, what do you think is left for Eastwood, or is he reflecting back now?
No, he is not one of those people. He wants to do the work. He wants to do the work. I think he gets bored when he's not working. You know, I interviewed him once in Cannes. There was a public event, and I asked him, you know, if he was going to retire, and this was a number of years ago. And he kind of gave me one of these looks, and he said, you know, I play golf. I like to play golf. I don't want to have to play golf. You know, he really wants to be involved. He really likes the mechanics of filmmaking. He likes the mechanics of storytelling. I mean, apparently there is another film he is in the process of finishing, you know, courtroom drama. I mean, as long as he can work, he will work. I have no doubt of that. You know, and you know, in Europe, there have been directors who've worked to great age to further into their 90s. So this is not it's unprecedented for American directors, but not internationally. He loves to work. You know, his films continue to be, you know, solid at the box office. You know, no one's going to turn him down if he wants to make another film. And, you know, so far, so good.
Kenneth Turan, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed this interview. This was really terrific. Seriously.
Kenneth Turan. He was a longtime film critic for the Los Angeles Times and for NPR's Morning Edition. He's going to be at the screening of Unforgiven tomorrow night at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll put a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. It's pretty straightforward, though. You can get tickets there at the theater. They'll get started at 7. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you with ideas or comments or feedback. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.